drinking and using anymore. The problem's out of the way. Everything should be just hunky-dory because I'm not using drugs and alcohol anymore, and I don't even know why I'm not doing that. And I was stuck on step zero, eliminating alternative after alternative after alternative until you're down to two. Now, the screwed up thing about getting down to those two alternatives, when we get to them in the book, I'm going to help you see. When you finally see you think you got two, you don't have either one. Because you ain't been doing really well at dying an alcoholic death. You haven't been able to blot out the consciousness of your situation. And you don't have the power to live life on a spiritual basis. So as soon as you think you're two, you'll find out you don't have any. But then you'll be on step one with no alternatives rather than on step zero with more than two.
Thank you very much.
I would also like to talk about a couple more things that are important this weekend. The morality that Mark and I operate on is this. There is no good. There is no bad. There is no right. There is no wrong. The morality of Alcoholics Anonymous for me goes like this. Is it working for you? Is it working for you? He said it earlier. If you're happy, content, everything's wonderful, why do the steps again? Why do them for the first time? If everything's going great, this will be a really boring weekend with some information on some spiritual stuff that you can bring your virtue to and grow as a virtuous person that's having a wonderful life. If a prayer brings you to a new desperation that you've never had, either for the first time or the tenth time approaching this work, and you get some new desperation based on a current first step, the morality is this. What you're doing is not bad or good. What you're doing is not right or wrong. What the fellowship and those other people are doing is not right or wrong. The only question is this. Is it working for you? The only other thing I want to mention right now is questions. A lot of questions are going to be raised. A lot of questions are going to be asked. Here's the way to approach a question. Don't answer it. Anyone who has ever heard of Zen Buddhism knows there is a term. Anyone who's ever heard of Christian mysticism or contemplative Christianity, they use the word contemplation. Zen Buddhists use the word koan, K-O-A-N. Those are both. In Christianity, it's a verse, a word, or a statement from the scriptures that you choose to bring to your heart to get past mind to directly experiencing that which you've brought to your heart. Centering prayer, contemplation. In Zen Buddhism and in Tibetan Buddhism, they use the word koan. A koan is a question that's asked over and over and over to take you beyond mind to directly experiencing the question. And the first time I heard that, I realized that's what we've been doing with this book for a long time. Turning statements into questions. But the questions that we raise, because here's our pattern. We've been programmed our whole lives. Remember in school? Here's the question. First hand that goes up is the best. Who can answer it the quickest? Take the test. Finish it fastest. Give a question. Got to have an answer. Here's the test. Let's drop that. Let's ask for an open mind and a new idea with a way of approaching questions. These questions, especially in the first three steps, are meant to be considered, brought to your heart, and answered experientially. Let the answer come to you rather than from you.
So this weekend, and it's already happened on the first break, we have disturbed you about the question of alcoholism, some of you. So there's a belief system, let's get free of, that has almost killed all of us in this room, drinking and sober, and here's what it is. If it feels good, it's good. If it feels bad, it's bad. We spend a lifetime trying to avoid, quote, what we think is bad. So, if some of you have already been disturbed, the paradox is that's good. If some of you have not, that's bad.
Imagine you're working with someone. They've been using the set-aside prayer a month, 2 months. You've been in the first step. They've been in the first step. They come over to your house. You say, how are you feeling? Oh, everything's hunky-dory. I'm doing really well. Those are the people you worry about. Somebody's been doing the set-aside prayer. They come over to your house. I'm all fucked up. Wow, great. The prayer is working, because what are you praying for? an open mind and a new experience. And do you think your mind opening, which means old ideas being stripped away, is comfortable?
So, you know, you're back to something. You know, as we did our the first session, and just so you understand, you know, Joe and I pray and meditate, and we come and speaking happens. And we're not responsible and accountable. I don't know how else to say that. We, a long time ago, realized that we weren't the one doing this thing. So however it flows is however it flows. I mean, that's number one. That power has a sense of who needs what, and we don't, and we're vehicles. And the fear of it, when you get to the fear inventory, the big book says, God will demonstrate through you what God can do. So that's some of what is going to take place here. So you work with the path of consideration. Those of you who have questions, take some of those within yourself over the course of, you know, this this weekend. I want to, you know, there were a bunch of people that raised your hands about you were in your first year. And I'm going to assume that people, raise your hands again, those of you that you're in your first year for the first time. There were several of you. Raise your hands again, would you? Okay. Did someone ask you if you were willing to go to any length? Okay. And you probably said yes to that, correct? Okay. And you probably said yes to a question, and you didn't probably have any idea what that looked like, did you? See, because we don't do that. We don't do that with new people. We don't do it with each other. Joe and I want to do that with you. When it's time to go back through the steps, and my consciousness moves me into that. I'm recently coming through, having done some spiritual exercises with the first nine steps again. I like to sit with either three or four questions, depending on what's going on in my life, and I want to pose those really, you know, to you all. The first is, you know, do I want to do this? And do I want to do what this book is going to ask me to do?
Can I say something along those lines? I give these four questions to everyone that I work with, whether they're doing it the first time or the 20th time. These are the four questions.
So that's the first one, is do I want to do what is going to be asked of me?
Is this work what I want to do?
Yeah. And another question then behind that has to do with, am I willing? And the gentleman that raised his hand in the first year said he answered yes, but no one said to him and no one told him what that meant and what that looked like. So I want to read that to you all, those of you that are here, that your consciousness may move you to go back through this again. So I want you to be clear maybe what that looks like so you can truly answer that question if in fact you want to. Because it's real easy to say yes to a proposition when I don't know what it means. Correct? So I want to read some stuff from 12 and 13, just so we're all clear. Okay? And it says, it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Thus was I convinced God is concerned with us humans when we want God enough. I'll talk about that later on this weekend. At long last, I saw, I felt, and I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. I hope that happens with some of you. And then a new world came into view. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. For a brief moment, I needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have God with me, and God came. Now, those of you who have been sober for a while, pay attention to this next sentence. But soon the sense of God's presence was blotted out by worldly clamor, mostly those within myself. So it's been ever since, how blind I had been. At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Now we're going to talk about, if you all are willing to go to any length, we're going to talk about what this is going to look like. There, I'm going to humbly offer myself to God as I understand God. Now pay attention to these next few words before you think about this. To do with me as God would. I can assure you, when I made my third step decision, I did not plan on living in Texas. To do with me as he would. That means that your life will no longer be your business, so you might want to give that a little consideration before you go back through this work, because you may like the condition of your life right now. I'm going to place myself unreservedly. You don't think they mean unreservedly, do they? Unreservedly under his care and direction. No reservations of any kind. You're not going to come to the meetings anymore and talk ad infinitum about fear, because you've placed yourself unreservedly under his care and protection. Right? Am I willing to do that? See? I'm going to admit for the first time of myself I'm nothing. 20 years sober, right? Admit that of myself that I am nothing, that without God I am lost. Not was lost, am lost. See? I'm going to ruthlessly face my sins. Ooh, that word. That I have some old ideas about that really just means miss the mark. You don't think they mean ruthlessly. Yeah, I think you might be getting into fourth and fifth step and stuff like this. And I'm going to become willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. Root and branch, take them away. And wow, a promise is maybe if I'll do that, I don't have to have a drink. And then my schoolmate or somebody's going to visit me, and I'm going to fully equate this person with my problems and my deficiencies. I'm going to make a list of all the people I've hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. I'm going to express my entire willingness to approach these individuals admitting my wrong. Never am I to be critical of these people. I'm going to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability. Utmost of my ability. Get on the internet. Make phone calls. Go to any links to find these people. To pay this money back. To the utmost of my ability. And now I'm going to test my thinking by my new God consciousness. Common sense will become uncommon sense. I'm going to sit quietly when in doubt, which is a fairly consistent state of consciousness for us. And I'm going to ask only for direction and strength to meet my problems as God would have me. Never am I to pray for myself, except as my request bore and being useful to other people. Then only might I expect to receive, but that being great measure. And my friend promised when these things were done, D-O-N-E, now you're going to get some promises.
Not half done.
It says, I'm going to enter upon a new relationship with my Creator. Those of you who have been sober for a while. A new relationship with your Creator. You would have the elements of a way of living which will answer all my problems, plural. Plural, that's plural. All my problems, plural. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honest humility, to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. And then they summarize what's going to happen to us in this exciting thing we get to do. Simple but not easy. We all got to pay a price. Here it is. It means destruction of self-centeredness. You don't think they mean destruction of self-centeredness. Destruction of your self-centeredness.
But we're told all the time that we can smash our ego and bring about our own surrender. Mm-hmm. Oh, just go home and surrender, honey. That makes me feel like when somebody says, go home and just don't drink between meetings. Yeah. Or all I need to do is smash my ego. Holy shit, if we could smash our egos, wouldn't we all be doing better than we are tonight? Mm-hmm. I'd be ego-free, ego-less. I'd have an ashram in India. You'd all be coming to visit me, Matt, rather than me coming to Queens to visit you. Just get rid of your defects. You know, smash your ego. Just surrender.
See, and we must turn in all things to the Father of light, who presides over us all. I think that's an incredible. Now, that new man that raised his hand, who said he was in his first year, go back and when that people, those people ask you if you're willing to go to any length, don't you think it would have been kind of nice if they'd sat down and gone over some of this with you so you really know what you're answering? See, I'm not here to soft sell the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as outlined in the big book. You drink enough whiskey, this seems like a fairly easy set of propositions. But if maybe you haven't drank enough whiskey and you still want to run your life on self-will, they may seem fairly drastic. But I think it's important that when you're going to sit down and take someone through this process, or they ask you to be a sponsor, that you be very clear with them what this looks like. Take about 20 minutes. Get real clear. Turn to page 58. Go through these steps. Talk about these three inventories. Talk about this third step decision. Let them understand from that point on their life's not their own business, even if they think it is. Talk about this fifth step. You're going to sit down. We're going to go over all this stuff. You know, your deepest, darkest secrets. Of course, their sphincter's going to start twitching then.
You know, that's what 12-step calls used to be. 12-step calls used to be people going out, usually with a bottle of whiskey in their back pocket, to meet a drunk and lay out the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now it's a big deal to drive across town, to pick somebody up, to drop them off at a detox place, and they're really an addict, pump them full of alcohol, and tell them to go in and start their recovery that demands rigorous honesty based on a fundamental lie because they don't cover drug addiction, and let them start their recovery based on a lie that they're an alcoholic. That's a 12-step call nowadays.
So you get...
Sorry.
You get done... He and I work well, like Cheech and Chong, you know what I mean? So, I think it's important that we, you know, that we have a sense of what this means. Am I willing to go to any length? And, you know, when I went, let me say it this way, when I got taken through the steps again this year, I had to sit with that stuff. You know, my life's pretty good today. And I'll tell you something else, I'm a little bit awake. I'm not naive to what's going to happen through the process of the steps. I had to sit with this a little bit. Why do I say that? Because this has happened to me before, and I wound up living in another state, working, doing a whole other job, and didn't know a single human being. That's why. Because I know if I go back through this again, most of the belief systems I'm operating on, taking action on, are all going to get smashed and destroyed. I know you can't pour old wine into new skin. I know that what I've been doing with 10 and 11 is going to get shaky. I know I'm going to get real, real uncomfortable. I don't know what's going to happen. My life is good, you know.
When I went through the work 13 years sober, I was in Santa Monica. I had 5 years in Denver, Colorado from 82 to 87, 10 years in Los Angeles from 87 to 97, and 5 years in northern India. If somebody would have said to me the last time I went through the work before India that any lengths was going to mean and describe what would go on in my life for the next 5 years, I would have had some considerations to make. If somebody would have said my fourth or fifth time through the work in Denver that I was going to leave Denver, move out of his house, sponsors down the street, service commitment, serving on the area committee, and that I was going to be moved to California, and this is what I was going to be doing the next 10 years, I would have had some considerations. So, as far as those of you that want to lay out the assignments that I would give somebody, and I know Mark does the same thing, first thing I would give him, and I don't tell him how to say the set-aside prayer anymore. My sponsor pulled a joke on me not too long ago when I called him, last time I called him. You can imagine this one, Matthew. He said, and I thought he was being serious, he said, "You know, you stuck me with something, son, that I've been blamed for a long time, and I thought some horrible thing I did in Denver or something." And I said, "What?" And he said, "The set-aside prayer." Because to me, the set-aside, from him, it was a comment to a maniac that he heard share his experience, and he said, "My God, son, you know enough about yourself, alcoholism, and how you feel to be dangerous to yourself and everybody around you, why don't you just say a prayer for an open mind and a new experience? That's where that prayer came from, right? Now he hates that. We've ritualized it, formalized it. It's in the workbook. It's written out. I just say to people, please, are you here for a new experience with the steps? Yeah. Try a prayer in your own words, in your own way, to whatever you believe in. Krishna, Muhammad, Christ, whatever you believe in, say this prayer. Put aside what I think I know for an open mind and a new experience. And I'll tell you, 99.9% of the time when they come back in a week or so, those with first step reservations that are going to come out in a little bit, they will have changed the set-aside prayer to this. They even did it in this damn workbook from Santa Monica. They'll change it to this. Dear God, please help me set aside everything I think I know. All of a sudden, God's the helper, and I'm the one that's going to set the stuff aside. Right? Old Dan Sherman's changed it into, dear God, enable me. Now God's an enabler. Right? God's a dysfunctional enabler. Gandhi has an eating disorder. Right? And dear God, enable me to set aside everything I think I know. No, 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 no. God's not just a little helper you pull out of the closet. You know, when you need a little help with the stuff that's getting a little rough, just say to whatever you believe in, please set aside what I think I know for an open mind and a new experience. And whatever you want to put there in the middle, say it from your heart. About this day, what's ever in your heart that time. Say it in the morning. Say it during the day when it comes to you. Say it at night. Say it when you sit down to work on whatever assignment you're working on. So I give people some sort of prayer to do from their heart. Then the four questions. Is this work what I want to do? Don Coyes, the Native American teacher I had, who's 30 years sober now, I think, he always said, even the first time, he always said two things that have always stuck with me. If you're doing the work for the first time, enjoy it, because you'll never do the work for the first time ever again, and you'll never do the work without power. You know, when you're doing the work the first time, this is a long way back for me to remember, but I do remember this. Remember when you're doing the work the first time and you're just getting enough from each step to just barely do the next? You've gotten the first column out, you've gotten the second column out, and you just got enough to be able to do the third column. And then when you're done with the third, I've always said this, there's a miracle at each step, but the real miracle is when you're in the action of the next, right? And then he would also say, with the question, is this work what I want to do? It somehow involves the ego that's right there, that's currently there in the process of doing it, and quells it a little bit, because answering the question, is this work what I want to do, involves the ego to the point where the ego will be involved in you starting the process, and it'll get smashed. It'll think it's a part of it, because it helped you decide, is this work what I want to do? And your ego will get right behind it. Yeah, this work's what I want to do. Right? Are you willing to go to any length? And I don't think whether it's the first time or the umpteenth time, you ought to add something to that. Even though I might not know what any length might look like. I don't think when they say any length, they mean any length that I can currently dream up at this time. I think when they say any length, they could possibly mean
any length.
And I always thought that meant, you mean, I'm not going to be asked to do anything out of the parameters of the first 164 pages. Then you're stuck. You're worshiping the book. God is everything or he's nothing. And that spiritual stuff that's outside the program, that's how you refer to it. I don't see inside outside anymore because I'm not inside outside. Right? You're either living a spiritual life and everything you do is spiritual, or you're not living a spiritual life and everything you do isn't spiritual. There's no like outside. What are we like? What are we like? The minor stream, and somewhere out there in the city is the mainstream, and this is the unreal world, and now I'm functioning. Let me tell you this. If that's the real world out there, and you all know it a lot better than a lot of other people in this country, if that's the real world out there, I don't want to be a part of it. But we are. They ain't separate. Is this work what I want to do? Am I willing to go to any length, though I might not know what that might look like? Then the most important is, Why do I want to do this work? Do you think if somebody came to Mark Houston after answering the third question and said, I want to do the work to get my wife back, get everything straightened out and feel better, he'd say, time's up. Because he uses a timer and he's a busy man, right? People call him and he said, you got 3 minutes, timer set, go. Right? Why do you want to do this work? I don't want to give it away, but for me, if it doesn't have a little something to do with life and death, you might want to go somewhere else. For people that can, you know, there's people that can help alcoholics. I'm not one of them. Let me say this. This will get you to think. I do not look for people I can help anymore. I used to think that's our job, isn't it? We're supposed to go out there and look for alkies that we can help. You know what you end up with? Hard drinkers that a human power can help. You know what I look for? I look for mad dogs that nobody can help, and I point them to that which already is helping them, and they don't even know it. I point them to God. I quit helping people. It takes such a strain off you sponsors that feel so overwhelmed by all your pigeons, babies, proteges, or whatever demeaning name that you currently call them, call and tell you about. Just point them to God. Is it working? Keep doing it. Is it not working? Try this. But point them to God. Be a pointer. But don't be a sponsor that points them this way, because then all you're doing is collecting dependents you can claim on your income tax to God. Your spiritual income. How many? How many dependents do you have? 17. Consider this one. I gave this one to my friend that I'm helping with the work right now. I used to also believe that too, Chris. I can take people through the work. Holy shit, I must have thought I had a lot of power. What I have now? I don't have proteges, I don't have babies, I don't have sponsees. I have friends that I watch seek God. We do it together. I'm a human. I'm right there with them. You're fucked up? I'm fucked up. You did that? I did that. Let me tell you what I did when I was 15 years sober, right? My sponsor accuses me of being crazy sometimes. When I told him how I ended up going to India, he said, how could you not? How many people ever get an invitation like that? But I've had some times where I was just a little bit off track, you know. What are you doing out there in California with that kind of lifestyle you're living? I remind him, and this is going to be said, this is going to be said, it's going to finally be said, so when you meet him, you can ask him. Right? My sponsor, Don Pritz, when he was 7 years sober, moved to South Utah, married a Mormon woman, got a second wife. They all lived together. He was taught by the man, the saucer man, how to call the saucer of John Smith and make it appear. And he would take groups out onto the desert and call the saucer that John Smith is in, 7 years sober, having done the work. He took groups on the desert to call the saucer of John Smith, and then he had his, what he calls his desert experience, and left those two wives and came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, don't tell me going to India was crazy, right? Right? So, is this work what you want to do? Do you really want to do this work? I had a couple times. I haven't been through the work in 2 years till I asked Mark in March. Right? Couple times I decided, nope, now's not the time. To have the freedom and the grace and the power to be able to do, that's what the 10 steps about. Because if you've done the work before, you're not doing the work by yourself without power. You're doing the work with power, using 10 and 11 to do 1 through 9. We learned about that from Don Coyes and Don Pritz and all of our heroes. You're using 9, you're using 10, 11, and 12 to do 1 through 9. Right? You're deciding, proper use of the will, is this work what I want to do again? If you've ever gotten past your first set of amends, I'm only talking to two or three of you in the room. I saw you when your hands went up. Right? Everyone else, you're halfway through amends, three-fourths. You live in Texas. You live in New Jersey. I don't give a shit. You live in Harlem. You've had a spiritual awakening as a result of 1 through 9.5. This could be amazing, but you haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. The 12th step tells you. What's the other question? Is this work what I want to do? Am I willing to go to any length, though I might not know what that would look like? Why do I want to do this work? And why with me? Because when you leave my house, the kind of people that come to my house, that's what I'm going to ask myself. Why me? They better have a good reason why they've asked me. You're famous? celebrity, tapes, fuck you. Get out of here. Right? Why? Why me? And what areas are you currently being dishonest about in your life?
With yourself and with others. And look at every area of your life. IRS, you're giving your employer a fair day's work, relationship, significant other relationship, relationship with yourself, your physical body, your emotional state, your mental state. What areas are you being dishonest with yourself and others? You know, it's funny. Joe and I were laughing the other day. Consciousness says, let's takes us back through the steps again. But he and I were laughing because what's happened as a result of that, when that begins to come up, we both kind of begin to suffer from PTSD. I mean, we were living in Denver with a great life and begin to go back to the work. And the next thing he knows, he's out in Los Angeles, right? And that kind of deal's going on. And I wind up in Texas, and then I've lived in four places in Texas, and jobs start and jobs end. And I don't know if he's thought about this, but he had begun the process of going through the steps and then ultimately winds up down in India, which is, that's a little jaunt. And he's down there, and I think, what, maybe 2 years ago started the steps again. And now here he is sitting in Queens, and he's not in India anymore. So when we sit down and answer these questions, we really like to sit with them for a little bit. Because we have a lot of experience, what that could truly mean is at somewhere in the middle of these steps, I could be in the other side of the continent. And we know that today.
And the ego will want to answer him right away. Sure, I want to do the work. Then you've just shut off. Here's the deal. If you're posed with a question and you answer it right away, you've stopped any experience you can have with the question because you've already gone to what you already know. Sit with the question. Let the experience come. Don't answer it right away. Give yourself, and always look at every question that we're going to pose at the first three steps that are these first four ones. Look at a question as a coin. Every question has two sides. Those that have been around for a while, you will get much more benefit, like from the first question. Is this work what I want to do? Don't answer it. Look at, maybe I don't. Am I willing to go to any length to do this work again? Maybe I'm not. That's how you look at a question, like a coin. Does your experience abundantly confirm that once you put alcohol in your system, something happens which makes it virtually impossible for you to stop? Sure. Then you're done with the experience of it. You've stopped the experience by the answer. And that goes so much against the way we've been programmed. The answer stops the experience. The consideration. Mark should talk now about three types of people that approach the work.
Yeah, I want a couple other comments on you approach the work. Those of you that know Chris R., walk up and ask him about the changes in his life as a result of reworking the steps. See? Walk up and ask Mike Lawrence about his life. You know, I'm telling you, ignorance is bliss sometimes. But there's probably reasons in the big book why they tell you, you know, you really ought to consider this, or why prior to the third step, they say, you really need to think about this, making sure you are ready. See? Making sure you're ready. It's one thing to say you want to go back through the process again and experience a revolutionary spiritual experience when you don't have a car and your life's upside down. It's a whole nother deal. Maybe when your life, you know, there's a line which I think sums this all up, and which at times will kill us. We become victims of the delusion that we will be happy and satisfied if we only manage well. Meaning we think we know what our life should look like. Our life should look like, who should be in it, where we should live, where we should work, etc., etc., etc. And that has descended on me many times in my sobriety. And I've suffered the consequences of that. But
a guy from Denver moves to L.A., I'm 12 years sober. I put myself in a position in my own home group where a heavyweight moves from Denver to L.A. Now, all of a sudden, He's the only one I can go to, qualified to take Joe Hawk through the work. Whoa, right? Mark had already been the one that told me after I was there 2 years when I had an inventory, and I said to Mark, Don Pritz is the only person that can hear this inventory. Mark said, how many years you been in Santa Monica? I said, 2. He said, where does Don Pritz live? I said, Denver. He said, could Don Pritz die at any time? I said, yes. He said, what if something happens to Don? You better let some people get to know you where you live. And I had done many fist steps with people in Santa Monica, in my home group, and with women. If you're a man and you miss the experience of ever fist stepping with a woman, you've missed it. If you're a woman and you've missed the experience of fist stepping with a man, we're going to get into that later too. Multiple fist step. Book says it. So he moves from Denver to LA. I go right to him. I got to do 1 through 9. He said, great. He said, let's go to the liquor store. I said, cool. I thought we were going to go to the liquor store. He said, no, right here in my living room. I said, cool. He said, okay, you're 12 years sober. You just pulled up to the liquor store. Where are you at? How's it feel? He took me right there. I was there. I said, you know, I'm not feeling much at all. I'm a little bored. It ain't too exciting, and it ain't too depressing. You know, that's the place I hate. I can handle severe depression, and I can handle mania. But don't give me a mediocre day, 12 years sober. Don't give me mediocre. I got to be doing something. I'm taking people through the work. I'm speaking all over the country. I'm controversial, right? It's a mediocre day. I just pulled up to a liquor store, 12 years sober. He says, how's it feel? I said, blasé. He said, walk in. He said, where's your wall? He said, is your wall brown or is it clear? I said, my wall's clear. It's vodka. He said, what kind do you want? I said, citronelle. I heard about it. It's flavored vodka. They didn't have it 20 years ago. I got to have some, because I drink kamikazes. I drink vodka, right? And I heard there's some new vodka that's flavored already. Give me some orange, whatever it is, Stoli. He said, what size you buy? I said, liter. He said, you didn't buy a half pint? I said, what the hell's a half pint? I ain't had a half pint since I was, unless it's all I got, you know? I ain't had a beer since I was 17, unless I had to. He said, I bought a liter. He said, now you're buying it? Yeah. You're out in the car? Yep. How's it feel? Nah, not much. Nobody's going to know. He said, now tell me where that first liter would take you. I started into this long, elaborate story like you'd tell at one of these nauseating, like Chris, war story meetings. I had a big, elaborate idea of where that first liter would take me. The man laughed in my face. He said, you better go home and pray about that. Come back next week, same time. I woke up one more. Have you ever woken up laughing? I know you have. Have you ever woken up laughing at yourself? I woke up one morning laughing at myself. And I realized, you know what? I don't have a clue where that first leader would take me. Maybe nothing would happen. What if the grace of God protected me from the physical craving? God's everything. Oh, he wouldn't be there for that. We're going to talk about that this weekend too. What if nothing happened? Just get drunk, come back tomorrow. I don't need to tell anybody. Just show up at a meeting. I'm still 12 years sober, right? Maybe I'm dead the next morning. Maybe I'm in Tijuana. Maybe I'm calling him. Maybe I'm banging on a treatment center door. I don't have a clue where that first leader would take me. I went back and I told him. He said, good. Then he gave me one of these questions, I thought, along the lines of these four questions we've been talking about. I thought it was a Denver trick question. And a Denver trick question goes like this. If you say you're willing, you probably won't have to. But if you say you're not, you'll probably have to. So here was the question. Would you be willing to quit working with people and speaking or sharing anywhere until you're done with your next set of amends? And he got up and he went in the bathroom. And I thought to myself, okay, he's from Denver. If I say I'm willing, I won't have to. But if I have any resistance at all, then he'll say that I better. So then my mind went off. He stayed in the bathroom long enough for me to realize if I wasn't willing to put that stuff aside, I was going to drink. Because you know what my mind started saying? What will happen to those poor people that I sponsor? How can I not carry the message? Because I think working with others and carrying the message, once again, are things that keep me sober. He came out. I said, yeah, you know, I just watched what went on in my mind. I'm willing to do that. He said, okay. It wasn't a trick question. He said, quit working with people and don't speak and don't share until you're done with this next set of the next piece of work through amends. We both knew it would only be a few months. And he didn't want me to quit doing that stuff He wanted me to quit doing that stuff to see the subtle shift that I had turned those things into. And you know what I had turned those things into? You know how all of you that do what's in the big book make fun of those people that don't do what's in the big book because they got their own little list of illusions? I just don't drink. I go to meetings, 90 meetings in 90 days. I choose not to drink. But your ego's so slick, you got a neat, shiny, bright, cool-sounding list of new things. I read the book. I work with others. I take others through the work. I work the steps. And he wanted me to see that I had turned those things into my little list of what I do to keep myself sober rather than what you and I get to do to seek that which is already keeping us sober. And it's a big shift. It's a big shift because I had my little list 12 years sober of what I do to keep myself from pulling up to that liquor store. Think about it.
So the first
and I came back to those two things with a new attitude and a new appreciation.
So the first step, you answer those questions, and then you begin the path that Joe's talking about. Look in the big book from the doctor's opinion to page 23, 33 pages designed to answer one question. The issue of if I take a drink of alcohol, can I control? Those of you who have experience with both alcohol and drugs, look at both. Look at them separately. 33 pages. This is how intelligent we are. 33 pages are designed to answer one question. Mark, when you take a drink, you have power, choice, and control over how much you drink every time, yes or no? And I got to spend 33 pages to answer that because unbeknownst to me, there's a part of me finding every reason in the world why I do not want to answer that question in a particular way. Do you lose power, choice, and control over alcohol, Mark, when you take a drink? 33 pages. By the way, the mind that brought you to AA, the mind that has you sitting here tonight, at times that has you paralyzed with fear, the mind, the internal judge that, you know, it's that quote, if you said to me what I said to me, I'd have to kill you. That mind is not the organ that we're going to go into to have a revolutionary spiritual experience.
You can't use mind to overcome mind.
Your self-will cannot eliminate your self-will.
Can I talk about a couple things before we go in any deeper into step one that I think? I'll give you an example. I was telling this to Mark yesterday. I was in Dallas for five months with Mark. March, April, May, June, July. 12 people asked me to take him through the work. I gave 12 people the assignment we've been talking about. Just a simple prayer for an open mind and a new experience and the five questions. One out of four people went any further than that first assignment. Weed the people that don't want to do the work out before you waste any time. The book is real clear. If they don't want what you have to offer, let them go because you might spoil a later chance. We've all known people. Some of you in this room needed to drink again. Drinking again was a great thing for you, right? So there's another couple things. I want to talk about the difference between you, those of you in the room that have been in, and as we have, I want to talk about the difference between the grace of God and a conscious contact. Guy comes to me with 26 years. He had met Don Pritz and Gary Brown and Paul Martin at a thing in Nashville, Tennessee called the Music City Roundup. We had a small meeting up in the room. He heard something he never heard in 26 years. I was there. We get back to L.A. I'm the one he's stuck with. I'm not the one he wanted to ask. I'm just the only one that does this work this way in L.A. at that time that he knew. He would rather have asked Don or Gary or Paul. He gets stuck with me. It was a blessing. Give him a prayer. Open mind, new experience. He calls me back in a couple weeks. He says, Joe, I have a serious problem. I said, I know you do. What do you think it is? Don't let old comers scare you. Care about them enough so they don't have to keep dying. I said, I know you got a problem. What do you think it is? He says, for 26 years, I've been in the grace of God. I said, obviously, if you're alcoholic and you're not drinking, you're in the grace of God. He said, I've seen it in my life, every area of my life. I've sat with it. I've realized it. I've been in the grace of God for 26 years. Why do I need to do the work? I said, you better pray about it. I made it 6 months in grace. And a lady in my home group once said this, because the big slogan, you know how every area has their kind of their own set of new other slogans? I heard there's one, I think Bob told me one time that one of the slogans up where he lives is, keep it green. And I said, what is that? Has that got something to do with your lawn in Westchester County or your garden or something? You know, he said, keep the memory fresh. I said, but it says here that the memory of even a week or a month ago. They got a couple in Texas, I heard. Do the next right thing. That assumes I got the power to do the next right thing, the knowledge of what the next right thing is, right? So what was the one I was thinking? When I moved to L.A., one of the big slogans in South Central was, the grace of God is sufficient. It wasn't for this man after 26 years. He starts praying about why does he need to do the work if you're in grace? He calls me back and he said, can I come over? I said, sure. He said, he came over. He said, I know why I need to do the work. He said, I'm an alcoholic and I would like to have a conscious contact with that which has been giving me this grace for 26 years. And when he got on the other side of his first set of amends in 26 years, plus his whole life, Clint H., he talks about it all over the country. Wonderful man. The people he's been able to touch with time that I couldn't have had any effect on. It's been amazing. He said the difference between the grace of God and a conscious contact was like night and day, right? And I think another important thing before you start the first step is to realize this. I've never said this to Mark, but he knows it in his heart. It doesn't start with the first step. And I'm not talking about this pre-step one or step zero stuff we've been going over. It never started for you with step one. You know where it started for you? It started with you from someone across the room from step 12. Imagine in your first meeting if nobody had gotten past step one. That's why people in treatment can't help other people in treatment. It never started for me with step one. I thought for a long time I would have told him 6 months ago if he said, where did it begin for you? I would have probably said step zero, but it only took 6 months to get out of step zero, and then it started with step one. It didn't start with step one. It started with the 12th step in another man's heart who cared. Another place I'd like to look at before we start one is this. We don't need to read it, but in one of the most unread chapters, the chapter to the wives, why do I need to read it? I've never had one. I'm going to have one really soon. God told me. But I'm reading the chapter to the wives in that guy over there from Texas' brother's group, and I had an awakening. And in that chapter, we don't need to read it word for word. It says this. There's four types of alcoholics. It says type one may or may not even be alcoholic. Type two's begun to get in a little bit of trouble. Type two's a little bit worse. Type three is a little bit worse. Type four, screwed. We think that only has to do with two things. They can't control it when they start, and they can't keep themselves stopped. But the interesting paradox is, who do they say has a better chance at AA? Wouldn't you think like one or two? They say type four has a better chance at our program than the type that still have. You know why? Because those other types still have more than two alternatives. Type four is down to two. So I'd like you all somewhere at the beginning of the work to look at what type are you. Then I'd like you to answer this question. We had a nifty time, your brother and I, with this one. If there are four types of alcoholics described in our book, and they're all around us in AA, what message would each type bring to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous? And then you're going to see why you hear so many different messages. Type one, hey, I just don't drink no matter what. I found everything I ever wanted in the fellowship. I quit drinking. My life just got better and better. Type one, may or may not be alcoholic. Not our place to say. They need to find out. Doesn't matter what we think. Type two, what would be their message? Well, you know, I go to lots of meetings. I'm a meeting maker. Meeting makers make it. I do a little of this. I call my sponsor every day. 90 meetings in 90 days. I dump. I get better. Type 3, I don't want to offend anybody. Type 3, 1 through 9 and a half, 1 through 9 and 3 quarters, 1 through 9 and 3 eighths, never finish amends, think they've been through the steps, everything's hunky-dory, they've been through the 12 steps, and they've had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, and they're in delusion. Denial, denial, denial. Denial of what? Denial of alcoholism? How could they be? They're a type 3. They're in the denial of the grace of God. A form of denial that I don't hear any of you talking about in AA. A form of denial stronger than the denial I came here with, because I didn't have many alternatives left, and I didn't have a lot of denial when I got here, but I've suffered from this denial in AA. The denial of the grace of God, taking the credit and thinking those unfinished amends don't have nothing to do with alcohol. Because you're taking the credit, you're keeping yourself from drinking, or you're blaming God on your unfinished amends. But we don't need to go into that. Type number 4, came, got worse. Just because he quit drinking, he didn't get better. 1 through 9 once, didn't work. It worked. They hit another wall. Harry Thiebault's theory. For Harry Thiebault, it was just a theory. For me, it was a reality. The ego rebuilds itself if you're an alcoholic of my type. Maybe I'm the only type 4 in the room. Maybe Mark. Maybe Mark's a type 3 3/4, right? Maybe I'm the only type 4. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think there's some other type 4s. So look in the chapter of the wives. What type are you? Because Mark killed me with this. Type 4s can't do type 2 work. What type are you? And which type, what message would each type bring to AA? And if your life's on the line and you're a type 4, you better go to a type 4. And you better know the lineage you're joining. What if you ask somebody to be your sponsor? You know your life's on the line and everyone they've ever worked with has drank again. Because there's a difference between knowing the message, having done the work. There's a third component. Not everybody that's done the work is meant to transmit it. Does our book talk about transmission? Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And not everybody that's done the work is meant to transmit the message. Transmission is a very... Look at the people around them they've worked with. Look at the results they're getting. What type are you? What message would each type bring to AA? And who are you going to go to?
Let's take a 15-minute break.
Sorry. That's okay.
About 45 minutes more we're going to go this evening. And that'll shut things down. A few other things that came to my consciousness, I'll call them traps in their own way. Here's one. God keeps me sober. Why is that a trap? If there's nothing but God, there can be no God. And is God a part of staying sober? Of course. But what is the trap in the belief system, God keeps me sober? The trap is this. If that were true, the big book would be one page and it would have 5 words on it. God keeps you sober. Have a good life. Unfortunately, that is not what it says. There's 30 pages that really, really ask us to do a bunch of written work. There are several considerations prior to the written work. When the written work's over, we sit down and do a 5th step. When we're done with that, we identify a list of defects of character which have sprung out of a life based on self-will. We then ask God to take all of us, good and bad, assets and liabilities, if you will. We then make a list of all the people we'd harmed as a result of being asleep, dreaming we're awake, driven by self-will, feeling separate and alienated from everybody and everything, which, by the way, leads to continuation and fostering of self-will, that sense of separation. Then you make those amends and you pay all that money back and you begin to work with the disciplines of 10 and 11. And then the book is very clear at that point in time that you and I not drink alcohol one day at a time based on one thing and one thing only, which is called a fit spiritual condition. And you and I are given a daily reprieve contingent on that fit spiritual condition. We did the work and took the action in the first 9 steps. And then 10 and 11 is very, very clear and it has very strict spiritual disciplines about how we maintain that fit spiritual condition. So a question maybe for some of you to ask yourself, if you're not working with the disciplines of the 10th and 11th step, you might have fallen prey to that belief system, because my experience is God will not do for me what I am supposed to do for myself. And I'm the one that has to get my feet on the floor in the morning. And I'm the one that has to read pages 84 through 88 and work with whatever meditation books consciousness has sent my way. And I'm the one that has to sit in the silence, be still, and know that I am God. And I'm the one who has to work with the 10-step tools all during the course of the day. I get to do that. Pause, agitated and doubtful, watch, ask, turn, cease fighting, sixth sense, vision, thy will, line of the will. Work with that all day long, conscious awareness of that. Then I get to do an evening review, and I get to dovetail the evening review into corrective measures for the next day. And that's how, if I do these things, then the problem has been removed and I remain in a position of neutrality. So it's another trap. I fell for it. Who wouldn't? That's an easier, softer way, isn't it? God keeps me sober. I'm just going to a meeting. Right? That's the easier, softer way. I'll bet you every one of you in here has had periods of time where you've operated off that belief system versus the work of the strict spiritual disciplines. And so I see it as a, you know, I just see it as another trap that you can fall into. I've fallen into it, and if I have, I'll bet you have as well. Took me a long time to understand that, when the God is not responsible for my fit spiritual condition. God is everything, see? What isn't God? What isn't God's will? But there's these disciplines I have to follow based on my experience to remain in a position of neutrality. Fit spiritual condition. What does that look like? Am I willing to do that? Do I like the effect produced, you know, by doing that? Tell you a little story. You know, the big book says, Joe and I were doing a lot of stuff, what I'll call preliminary to step one, which I believe is essential. And I believe if we did more of it, we probably would have more people move through amends and work with 10, 11, and 12. But the story goes like this. One day, a pal of mine, he's out hunting. He likes to hunt. And this dog shows up, bird dog. And he's out shooting ducks. And the first time he shoots a duck and goes in the water, to his amazement, this duck walked across the water and retrieved that duck. And he shot two more that day, and that dog did the same thing, and it was just blowing his mind. He's in AA and used to miracles, so he thought, my God, this is incredible, a dog that walks on water. So he took the dog back home and, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, he happened to live next door to an alcoholic who was still drinking, who also liked to hunt. And so the alcoholic stumbled over that night, and he said, you know, are you going hunting tomorrow, Dale? And Dale said, yeah, I'm going hunting. And he said, I'd like to go eat. And he said, okay. So the next day, Dale and the drunk, they get in their truck and they go out to the duck blind. They got the dog there. And Dale just can't contain himself. You know, he just can't wait to see what this drunk's going to see when he watches his dog walk across water, right? So the first bird comes along and Dale pops that bird. And sure enough, that dog just walked across the water and retrieved it. And so they shot about 6 or 10 ducks, and that dog did that every time, and this drunk didn't say one word. And he's drinking beer, and Dale's just looking at him. That dog's just walking across the water, bringing them ducks back. Finally, Dale couldn't contain himself anymore, and he turns to the drunk, and he says, do you notice anything strange about that dog? And that drunk looked at him, he goes, you know I have. He said, you know the poor thing can't swim? That's the mind I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. See, and I'm going to go into that mind to solve my problems and to live my life. See? Probably not a good place to go. Another book talks about, says you'll be known by the renewing of the mind. In the doc's opinion, we talk about a psychic change. You know, someone asked me something outside. This has to do with willingness. I want to talk about this a minute. Life and death. See? If you're in this room and you've lost the connection between to drink is to die, if you have lost this concept, this idea that this is not life and death, you're going to take an easier, softer way. Ladies and gentlemen, this is life and death. Why is this important? To not lose this connection, that what we're talking about is life and death. because it gets very, very important as you begin to get moved through the course of action the big book is going to ask you to take. Faced with writing three inventories or dying an alcoholic death. Let me think about that a minute. You understand? We've been talking about amends, and it isn't just unfinished amends. There's some of you not working, probably not doing much with the disciplines of 10 and 11. There's probably some of you that haven't taken anyone through the big book in a while. There's probably some of you that haven't written inventory in quite some time. And it's called, well, what is that all about? And my experience, my personal experience with that is I forgot that this is life and death. See, it's like this. Let's see. I can make all my amends or die an alcoholic death. Let me think. So you walk up to a normal person who doesn't have our illness and say, look, they want me to write these three inventories in AA. They're going to take a little bit of time. And, you know, it's a resentment inventory, a fear inventory, and a sex inventory. Or they want me to make these amends. There's 100 of them. I got paid. And I can either do this or die an alcoholic death. What do you think I ought to do? They'd just say, get away from me because you obviously are dumb as a rock. But you see what we do? And what does this take us back to again? This takes us back to surrender. During the course of this weekend, I want to talk about this line in the book about being convinced to my innermost self in two ways. One has to do with my relationship with alcohol, a craving of the body, an obsession of the mind, and a spirituality. But I also want to talk about this in relationship to self-will. Am I convinced to my innermost self that living a life, drunk or sober, regardless of how long I'm sober, based on self-will, cannot and will not work. And I'm going to talk more about that. About, you know, Joe, those of you who've ever showed up, anything Joe and I have done, we seem to always take a lot of time looking at the first step. And the reason is it's the foundation of the spiritual arch to which you walk a free man and a free woman. That's why one-third of the big book is devoted to the considerations of the first step. Is this you? Are you a real alcoholic? Are you that person on page 21? That you've lost the power of choice. That sober, the most insane thing you will ever do, you will do sober. Those of you that said you had the power of choice, I work with, I don't know if there's such a thing as reincarnation. But I just have to assume if there is in the last lifetime, I must not have been a very good man. And I say that because I get to sponsor chronic relapsers. And their four favorite words are I know and yes, but. They know everything, you know, about everything. And I love to ask them this question. Were you involved in your last relapse? And every time, without exception, they tell me they were. And I ask them where they got that idea. And they'll say, what are you talking about? I say, where are you getting the idea that you are involved with your relapses? I said, do you believe that you're involved in choosing to drink? And they'll go, well, yeah. And I'll say, have you ever looked at the big book, pages 23 to 43? Do you not understand that if you're a real alcoholic, you've lost the power of choice, and the most insane thing you'll ever do, you'll do it from a state of consciousness called sobriety. And that is that there will come a time when you'll have no effective mental defense against the first drink. Your mind will say, let's take a drink. And if something doesn't stand between you and that, you'll go drink. They've never understood that. See, that's called losing the power of choice. And I'm very, very clear on that piece. See, I don't have the luxury of not staying in fit spiritual condition even one day, because that day I believe a guy like me is rolling craps. Now, I don't do what I do out of fear. I do it out of love, because I like the effect produced by conscious contact with God. See, I do this for the same reason I drink. I like the effect produced by alcohol. I do what I do with these disciplines because I love the effect produced by conscious contact with that which created me. That sense of separation is now gone from me. See? But this is life or death. This is not some little flu we got. It's going to go away. See? With a little pill or a little bit of time or, you know, those kinds of things. So those are some things that I wanted to talk about. Ask yourself, have you been caught up in this belief system of God keeps me sober? Big book says, fit spiritual condition, Mark. Daily reprieve based on this. By the way, it says this is what you do. This is how you do this thing. So we've talked about those questions and those considerations. We've talked about willing to go to any length, and I think we have a much greater picture for all of us of what that looks like. Then you start looking at the first step, 33 pages, to look at this issue of when I take a drink, do I lose power, choice, and control? And by the way, use your experience to answer the questions out of the big book. Don't pay any attention to what your mind tells you. That's the same mind that has you doing insane things sober. So go into your experience to answer the questions in the big book, and there's many questions and considerations in there. Let your experience tell you what happens when you take a drink. Do you lose power, choice, and control? For those of you who do drugs, what is your experience? When you do drugs, do you lose power, choice, and control? You crackheads, when you get a crack pipe and you got about 9 hits, and you're doing that first one because you love the bouquet, ask yourself this question. Based on your experience, do you lose power, choice, and control over how many you do? See? In pages 23 to 43, I believe, based on my experience, probably the least read and least understood pages in the book. Here's why this is important. If you do not understand 23 to 43, the rest of your time in AA, Joe brought up a great point of the four kinds of alcoholics and what are the messages. If you don't have a deep experience with 23 through 43, the rest of your time in Alcoholics Anonymous will look much different than mine, I can assure you. Because I'm a type 4. I'm a hopeless, helpless, chronic alcoholic who was a daily drinker. A daily drinker. 24/7. That's what I did. You got in my way, you were gone. Period. End of statement. Alcohol was my master. I worshipped at the throne of alcohol. I may as well have had an altar. God, the truth of this hit me one day sober, and I tell you what, I wept like a baby about the hold that alcohol had over me. I may as well have had an altar and knelt at that altar and say, alcohol, you do with me as you will, because you do. Because you're more important to me than anything in my life. Anything in my life, and I will serve you. See? I'm here to serve you. And the unacceptability of that to this day is a piece of why I'm sitting up here. I got tired of worshiping at that altar. And it's an altar, and don't think any different. See, every alcoholic I've known, to me, there's only two gods. One's either alcohol and the other's the God of your understanding that you're going to serve. See, and that becomes that. But pages 23 to 43, I beg all of you, go back in with an open mind and read those. Read those pages. Look at your experience to be convinced of what? That the truth is, none of us in this room, unless we're in fit spiritual condition, have a clue what the day looks like when our mind's going to take us back to a drink, and there ain't nothing between us and that. There's no choice, there's nothing. And it's contained in those pages. And the sense of helplessness and hopelessness behind the realization of that, you know, is summed up. They describe, for those of you who think your mind can do anything about a drink or your beliefs, they describe in those pages something called a strange mental blank spot. And in a strange mental blank spot, every reason you have for not taking a drink is unavailable to you, including your belief in God. And if you don't experience that, in fact, you've been there probably several times, and by the way, this is a place we get to experience sober. Why would you seek power? Why would you need to work these steps? You follow me? See, I found myself in those pages. I was at the bottom of page 43. Once more, Mark, at certain times. That's the crapshoot. Mark, at certain times, I don't know what the time looks like. Mark has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Sober. They're talking to me sober, right? Mark's defense must. Doesn't say maybe. Says must come from a power greater than himself. And my experience abundantly confirmed this. That sentence and that experience with those pages took me from being an atheist to a seeker of God. Or let me say it another way. A seeker of the power behind the name. Not interested in the name. The name has been misused and overused and conjures up all kinds of belief systems. We're the kind of people, the name isn't important. See, Joe and I are sitting up here because of the name Stoli Vodka. We drank a lot of what was in that bottle. So I'm not interested in the name God, but I'm real interested in the power behind the name and having an experience with that.
And there's the question. Are you more interested in conception or consciousness? Go ahead. We talked about four types. We're going to find out it's good to look at, but it's not the major point in the first step. We're going to start talking tomorrow about taking all the drama, all the trouble, the length of time, the amount. We're even going to find where it says that hard drinkers could actually be worse than a real alcoholic. We're only going to focus on two things. Can you control it once you start? And can you keep yourself stopped once you stop? I brought up those four types of alcoholics because the book does, to help you see why there's four types of messages in the program. And if you don't know this, it's going to hurt you. We're surrounded by hard drinkers who were given a sufficient reason. We're surrounded by them in AA. A lot of non-alcoholics in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not our place to find out. Every time my debate goes off on, you know, those people. We were talking about it last night. You know why I've had to write inventory about people that don't need to do the work? Because I want to be one of them. I resent them because they don't have to do the work and I do. Right? On the other side of the work, I'm always really grateful. Because it wakes me up and it changes my life. Story about the Mad Dogs. Take 100 people from Alcoholics Anonymous, God forbid, put them back in the bar. You know what you're going to find? 20 or 30 sitting at the bar, right on those stools, wallowing in their whiskey, crying in their beer, because they don't know there's much more to find in alcohol. They just sit there whining and complaining and talking about their problems with their buddy, the bartender. Just like a lot of people in your groups. The bartenders in your groups. Serving up drinks. Then you got 20 or 30 come in the bar, drink till they feel good, then they go home. Then you got about 20 or 30 that seem to stand out in a crowd. Mad Dogs. Don't settle for sitting up the stools, wallowing in their whiskey, crying in their beer, because they know one thing. There's more to find in alcohol. Won't settle for coming in the room, drink till they feel good. They usually have to do that just to leave the house. Right? That's just where the night begins. They're going there, they're going here, they're going there, they're getting in fights, they're going to jail, they're going for the gusto, do it to the max, bop till you drop. They don't understand kind of, sort of, maybe little. Not even in their vocabulary. Now, put those 100 people back in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'll find they do the program about the same way they did in the bar. Okay. Are you a mad dog? Now I got to talk about something that I'm really disturbed, and I feel sad for the new people who might only see the fourth edition of the big book. You know, not many of us collected books. You came in, I got a third edition, I always read the third edition. I didn't come in before 76, I came in 82. I always had a third edition. And they were not allowed to change that book since 1976. What were the other years? 39, 55-76. I love when Chris Raymer talks about, and a lot of people in Texas talk about, the success rate when they were brought to recovery before they were brought to the fellowship. 50%, boom, right away. 25% came back, made it. 75%. Tell me anywhere in the world that Alcoholics Anonymous success rate is 75%. And you know what that taught me? Be really careful you're not doing what the majority of people around you in AA are doing, because the majority of people in AA don't stay sober. Do what the minority does. I'm proud to be a member of a minority, brother. Because the majority, you can't tell me more than 51% stay sober. So be careful you're not doing what the majority does, because the majority in Alcoholics Anonymous drink again. Now, because I was in India and they didn't consult me before they wrote the